Yeah, Capone's, they don't make them do a lot. So they keep it really simple for them. Nice college offense. Kingsbury's the OC, so you know, a little move guys around here and there, but you know, just keep it real simple for him. I heard his pass percentage is very high, but he's only throwing short route, you know, some intermediate stuff, quick throws.
Cam Taylor Britt, the Cincinnati corner, who had a great interception on Patrick Mahomes last Sunday, basically talking about Washington's college offense and how they have simplified it for Jaden in these first 2 weeks. Doesn't seem to be super threatened by what Washington's bringing in to town. There are a lot of offenses that look like Washington's in the NFL right now, but that's another subject. Ben Standing's usually with us at noon on Mondays and Fridays. He'll join us from, I'm guessing you'll be in Cincinnati when we talk to you on Monday, right?
Yes, Cincinnati or possibly Kentucky. If I'm, that's where my hotel is. I'm kind of excited. I've never been to Kentucky before, so there you go.
Well, the airport in Cincinnati is in Kentucky. A lot of people don't know that.
I honestly didn't until I booked this trip. I've never been to Cincinnati either, so.
I had to go to Cincinnati a lot. Kroger, which at one point, I don't know if it's still true, was the largest supermarket chain in the country, was a huge client of mine. They were based in Cincinnati. I think there was like a 10-year period where I was in Cincinnati once a month, once every 2 months. You can have Cincinnati, honestly. It's fine. It's like a lot of other Ohio cities. Cleveland's actually got some beautiful areas. Cincinnati's not terrible. But the airport is in Kentucky, which is where a lot of the airport hotels are as well. So enjoy your first trip to Kentucky. Lexington's beautiful, beautiful. Louisville, not so much. All right. I did want to actually start with something that I saw that you tweeted out. It was Jason Kelce on Philadelphia radio, I think, making a comment about Josh Harris's other team, or one of his other teams, the Philadelphia 76ers, where they are trying to get a new arena built downtown, and it's not been easy. You tweeted out what Jason Kelce said. Share it with everybody.
Well, I mean, the basic, so I think there's a couple of things. So if you've ever been to Philadelphia, it's a very unique setup. They have all the four teams, the main pro sports teams, are all located in the exact same spot on this big complex, which is pretty fascinating. And I'm sure for fans, it's all probably, you know, great. It's a great situation. You know exactly where to go and all that. But Josh Harris does not own the arena where the Sixers play, and he, you know, wants that for the, you know, all the obvious reasons he'd want to own a building. So he's trying to build one downtown in their downtown, and people don't really want this because they would, in part because it would break up that setup there. The other aspect of this is if he can't get a team built, if he can't get the arena built downtown, the other location seems to be across the river in Camden, New Jersey, which is, you know, not far from where they are, but, you know, sort of this is a little bit like what Ted Leontis was doing with possibly moving Cap One to Virginia. So, yeah, Jason Kelce was like, look, I know eventually we'd all be fine with it, but right now I just hate the idea because there's this tradition and all that. And this feels like a much, like right now everybody's like happy-go-lucky here about, oh, we want Josh Harris, it's all great, just build a new stadium. We almost kind of don't care where it is, but prefer RFK, but almost don't care. They're like, no, don't do this, don't move. But yeah, it feels like, you know, it seems like Harris is, you know, wants to get this done, but there's definitely a lot of opposition.
I mean, is it a fair description to say that he is not a popular owner of the Philadelphia 76ers with Philadelphians?
Yeah, it seems that way. I mean, I'm not there. I'm not emotionally tied to it. I've always been a big proponent of the process, but even that now, it's been a while. You know, you can't keep talking about that to a certain degree. But yeah, look, they have, they haven't gotten over the hump. They haven't gotten out of the second round, despite the fact that with Joel Embiid, they've turned into one of the top contenders in the league year over year, 50 win seasons. But yeah, they haven't gotten further. You know how it is, fans. At some point, winning in the regular season isn't enough. And now, you know, now this aspect of it. And one of the things Kelce said, I don't know if it was in the clip I retweeted or it was a different one, but he said, hey, look, you know, I don't know that this Josh Harris cares about Philadelphia, right? He owns a team in New Jersey. He's not from here. He owns now another team in Washington. Like, it's not like he's of here, which is ironic in the sense that one of the reasons I think Josh Harris is a favorable person here is because he is one of the fans, right? I mean, he grew up here. He knows the history. Same with, you know, Mitch Rales. Like, there is a connection there, and I think that's partly why people liked his ownership group. Yes, I'm aware that the last owner was also from here, but you know, I think that's the irony here, that here he's one of us, so to speak, and then up there he's an outsider who now wants to change things that we like here.
Yeah, the quote from Jason Kelsey on, I think it was WIP Radio, quote, "They're strong-arming the city. What do you do? Do you risk losing the 76ers? It just sucks. The ownership group isn't Philadelphian. He's got a New Jersey Devils team, a Philadelphia team, and now a Washington team. And now they're forcing the city to do what this guy wants, and it sucks." That's Jason Kelsey, you know, Monday Night Countdown. He'll be with Scott and their Monday Night Countdown group, not in Cincinnati, but in Bristol, because there are two games, as Scott told us the other night. When there are two games, they do the show from Bristol. But we'll see what Jason Kelsey says about Washington's chances and Washington's new franchise here, because clearly he's not a big fan of Josh Harris. But just so everybody understands, what Ben said, I believe, is true. Like, this is his dream, you know, property that he owns. This is what he grew up rooting for. You know, it's the 76ers and the Devils ownership is also part of Harris Blitzer, and Blitzer more, you know, isn't necessarily a D.C. guy. Blitzer's a New York guy or a Philly guy? I'm forgetting now.
I'm not positive. But
he's
Harris
not.
Obviously has ties.
Go ahead.
Okay. No, I was going to say Harris has some ties to that area from college days. But, I'm not 100% sure where Blitzer's from, but somewhere, up the 95 corridor.
Yeah. Blitzer grew up in Jersey. He's a Jersey guy and went to Wharton, where I'm assuming that's where he met Josh Harris. All right, let's move to football and Monday night. Let me just start with this, and I know that you don't think this is a big topic, and I'm kind of with you on this, but do you think Jamin Davis will be active and will have a role in the game Monday night against Cincinnati? And can you identify specifically the reason he didn't play last week for everybody that may have missed it?
Well, to the latter point, just going off of what Dan Quinn told us, they knew that Johnny Newton was going to play, but be limited. He ultimately only played 12 snaps, so they wanted to have an extra defensive tackle option. So they brought up Carlos Watkins from the practice squad, and that led them to having to make a decision. We have to, drop one of the defensive ends we have, and they went with Jamin Davis, and they kept up Javonte Jean-Baptiste, the seventh-round pick. I think that is notable in and of itself. So, now, ironically, Carlos Watkins is gone. The Cowboys picked him up off Washington's practice squad this week. And Quinn told us today or yesterday that Johnny Newton is going to get more snaps this week. I don't know how much more, but he'll get more. So based on that, they still have another defensive tackle they could bring up if they wanted to off the practice squad, but I would assume they may not if Newton's going to play more, and therefore Jamin Davis, I would guess, will be active this week. But, he's a guy that played 12 snaps in the opener. I think he was definitely on the bubble to make the roster, and he's been asked to switch positions for, the second time in his 4 years. I think, he was a first-round pick, but to a certain degree, it is sort of a sunk cost at this point, especially with the new group. So I don't know that he's got, favored nation status the way I think people are kind of hoping because of the first-round pick. But that said, he has improved over the summer, and he did make some good plays in the opener. So I would think he'd be active this week, unless, the Johnny Newton thing is, more of a red herring that Quinn was throwing out there.
You said something to me earlier this week when we were talking, not on the air. You had kind of predicted early on that Jamin Davis, before anybody was really talking about it, that Jamin Davis could be one of those possible, in the moment, which would have been like March or April, a surprise cut. And then, they had these issues at corner. Tariq Castro Fields in particular played pretty well. He was one of the first players picked up off of waivers. How close do you think it was with Jamin Davis making the team?
Well, I think the surprise there, and I think for most of us, was that they let go KJ Henry. I didn't see that. He seemed to be, I'm not saying he was going to become an ultimate starter for in this league, but he seemed like an ascending player, not just at the end of last year, but even this summer. He was playing high in the rotation all training camp, and then they let him go. So I thought that Henry would be ahead of Jamin Davis. Obviously, they viewed it differently, and that was a big difference there. But, yeah, I have to believe that Jamin Davis was, in that discussion of, like, well, what should we do here? I do think so. Well, one thing I found interesting, I think we talked about this also, was that this is the minutia stuff that I care about. They kept Byron Pringle on the original 53, right? Let KJ Henry go. Let Tariq Cascarfield go. Not that he was like a dynamic corner, but it gives you more depth at a position they are clearly weak at. They let both of those guys go to keep Pringle, who they then cut the Friday before the week one. And I thought, well, maybe this is one of those deals where they don't want to guarantee the veteran contract or bring him back. Obviously, they haven't. So it's very weird that they kept the guy who they then cut before the season started and let go two young guys who I would think at a minimum you could, keep and see what you have. Obviously, they moved on. I would love to know the reasoning for that, because I don't know why you couldn't have kept KJ Henry as well instead of cutting a guy that you ultimately decided to move on from right before the season started.
KJ Henry actually has played in the first two games, or he played against Kansas City, played 12% of the snaps for the Bengals. So they will see KJ Henry on Monday night. Cascarfield has been active too for the Panthers, or at least was last week. And defensively, let's see how many snaps he got, if anybody really cares.
I don't know if he played any.
He was special. He was a special teams player last week for them. But he's on their roster and has been active, or was active on Sunday. All right. We don't have to spend a lot of time on this one either. But we've talked about this, together, and we haven't. I don't think we talked about it on Monday when you were on, but. You've asked some of the questions. You asked some of the questions of Dan Quinn, I think yesterday, about the Terry McLaurin production. So what is your opinion on 4.9 yards per reception, 6 catches last week for 22 yards, and kind of the slow start to 2024 for number 17?
Yeah, look, this is a deja vu all over again situation, talking about Terry McLaurin needing to get him the ball more. At the end of the day, every year he gets 1,000 yards, can make some big plays, and then, we're always going, okay, well, be more consistent. And I think for me what sort of triggered a new thought on this was last week, where Malik Nabers in his second game, he's considered to be, he was the number 6 pick, looks like he's going to be one of the bigger, better receivers in the league. He had 18 targets last week. That's more than Terry McLaurin has ever had. McLaurin's had 14 a couple of times, and they just kept force-feeding the ball. So I've been trying to think, or ask questions, okay, why is it that some teams can get the ball to a guy, even though the defense knows where it's going to go, where other times they can't? And, the answers I've gotten both from a little bit from Dan Quinn and others is, you can move the player around the formation, and, sometimes teams are willing to just throw the ball to a certain guy, and other teams say, no, tell your quarterback, throw it to the open guy, no matter who it is. And I think that's what they've been telling Jaden Daniels. They're not telling him to force it. I think what's going to be interesting, not now, but as we go through this season is, this is now, Terry's 7th year? Or 7th year? Or 6th year? Since 2019. And every single year, right, it's a different week one quarterback. He's now had 4 different offensive coordinators. He never has had a much help at the other receiver spots, right? But at some point, you got to have to sort of ask the question: Is this guy, just not that guy? He's not the guy you're going to, dominate with touches or targets. And Terry is fast, but he's not the fastest receiver in the league. He's okay with size, but he's definitely not a big receiver. His best plays has always been in these contested catches, these lobs that sort of Taylor Heinicke would throw his way. But those are the passes that are scary. Because you're depending on the receiver to make a play when he's not necessarily open, so that's not where their eyes go. So I think it'll be interesting to see, how this goes. It's obviously been a very slow start, but at least last week the offense, still picked up over 400 yards. Noah Brown was a big help. I think his role is going to increase. I would imagine. I wrote about him today for The Athletic. Look, Zach Ertz has made plays. The two running backs are obviously factors in the passing game. So they have a couple other options. But, yeah, how they spring McLaurin open, or, you know, do they have to kind of rethink his role? I'm not saying they do, but I think it's going to be interesting as we go through the next few weeks.
I watched the Jaden Daniels presser from yesterday, and I thought it was interesting. He talked about Terry, but then when it got to Noah Brown, the thing that he immediately said was he gets separation. And I think he said he was impressed with, you know, kind of the work ethic, the whole thing, but he emphasized separation. I'm sure you picked up on that, but you've also written about Noah Brown in The Athletic here today. I'm assuming that there's a really good chance that Noah Brown ends up getting a lot more snaps and a lot more opportunities.
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah, I did pick up on that separation comment. And look, it's, you know, it could be a very innocuous comment, but since it's on the brain, we've all been talking about this now for the last couple of years at least, where's the separation, or why are guys open? And then Noah Brown delivered some of that. I wrote him today. You know, I knew, probably like many, I knew he was on the Cowboys, but didn't think too much about him. He was mostly a special teams guy for his career. Last year, fantasy football players certainly knew of him when he had two monster games. One game, he had like 173 yards, another one about 150. But what happened to him with Houston was the same thing that's happened to him his whole career going back to Ohio State. Injuries. Every time it seems like he's about to break out as a receiver, something happened. Urban Meyer, because he went to, you know, he was the coach when Noah Brown went to Ohio State the same year with Curtis Samuel and Terry McLaurin. And, Urban Meyer told me that, hey, look, this guy, he had the best overall skill set of any of those guys. He was, you know, our toughest receiver. He had great hand-eye coordination. But then in 2015, right when he was about to, you know, start or play a big role, he shatters his leg. And that just led to a whole bunch of injuries over his career, including, again, last year with Houston. You know, he helps them win the division, get to the playoffs, and then he only plays five snaps in two playoff games because of a shoulder injury that led to surgery that ultimately led, I think, to Houston moving on from him. But, you know, this is a really good opportunity. We know that the receiver hierarchy after McLaurin is very unsettled. He gives them a big body that they don't have, and he does have some, you know, playmaking ability, even if he's not going to be the fastest guy out there. So, yeah, if he and Jaden Daniels get on a good get some good chemistry, like if what we saw last week is, you know, a harbinger of things to come, I think Noah Brown could get interesting. And not to mention, you know, his ability as a blocker, you know, for a team that is now looking like their identity is going to be the two running backs, not to mention the quarterback that runs, I think having Noah Brown out there is a pretty big deal. Like, De'Ami Brown is willing to block, but he weighs like 30 pounds less than Noah Brown. So I think Noah Brown is in line for an expanded role for sure. Hopefully, for his sake, this is a time where he can stay healthy and not have any setbacks that have unfortunately plagued him throughout his career.
Do they have pretty good health heading into this game? Am I missing somebody that won't be available? I'm just trying to think through this right now. I mean, are they pretty healthy for Monday night?
Yeah, I mean, you know, because it's a weird week, so today's only the second practice. So,
right.
You know, there were a few guys who were on the injury report yesterday. Benjamin St. Juice was one that stood out. I think it was a groin. We had not seen him on the injury report, so that's one to see. But, you know, like Quan Martin, who was also on the injury report last week, and Cleon Farrell, they're both on it again, but they both played last week, so I'm not assuming too much there. But, yeah, by and large, they seem to be in pretty good shape, other than obviously the Emmanuel Forbes situation. He wasn't put on IR, but I can't imagine he's going to play. Next week will be the interesting one for him because it'll be the third week, and if you go on IR, you're out four. So we would think they're maybe targeting next week. But, yeah, other than that, they seem to be, you know, in pretty good shape, and that's, you know, kind of the way it's been all summer for them. So knock on wood, hopefully they keep that up.
All right, we will wait until Monday to kind of get your preview and pick, but I'll just ask you today, do you have a good feeling or not about Monday night? How much of a chance do you give them?
Well, I do think this is a very interesting game. You know, it's so weird. The first week and maybe the first 2 weeks of the NFL season now, it's so hard to read because nobody plays in the preseason, right? So, like, there's not – everybody's like, the first two games are almost, you know – advanced preseason games in the sense that, like, now these guys are getting out there, so the results can be kind of wonky. Obviously, Washington was pretty miserable in the first game. Last week, they won. But, you know, they squeaked it out against a Giants team that nobody thinks is any good. The Bengals are 0-2, and they lost to New England in the first game. New England looked terrible. But they also just were a pass interference call away from beating Kansas City last week. So this is a team, despite the 0-2, I still would say is an AFC contender. And, you know, Joe Burrow, Ja'Marr Chase, they haven't gotten going yet. T. Higgins might be back this week. They've got injuries on the defensive tackle side, which maybe helps Washington's run game. But this is a stern test despite the 0-2. So I think if Washington comes out there and there's competitive, win or lose, that's going to bode well for me. But right now, I just think the Bengals have more stuff. And I just think that the Joe Burrow, Chase, and a healthy T. Higgins, and they got a lot of tight ends that can catch against that secondary, that scares me more than whatever else Washington can do to them. But, we'll see what the health looks like for both teams on Monday.
All right, we will talk on Monday at Ben Standig on X on Twitter. Ben Standig writes for The Athletic, which, as I say every time Ben is on, is totally worth the couple bucks a month that you pay for it with, and he's got a podcast called Last Man Standig. Thanks. Talk to you Monday in Cincinnati.
I look forward to it. I'm going to see if turkeys can fly while I'm there.
See ya. Ben Standig, everybody. We'll do some Denton news, which will include the incredible season and the incredible game that Shohei Ohtani had last night. That's next. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980, the team980.com, where you're free and live on the Odyssey app.
Hitting the news you might have missed. It's Denton's Daily News.
This guy.
Denton, you want to share the details or you want me to do it?
I got it. I guess the simplest way of saying it is, dear God, he's really, really good. So Shohei Ohtani made history in more ways than one last night. He became the first person in Major League Baseball history. It's like 150 years of history in this game. First person in history to have a 50 home run, 50 stolen bases game. But the way that he did it.
Season.
But he did it in a game in which he went 6 of 6. 3 homers, 2 doubles, a single, 2 stolen bases. He became the first person in Major League Baseball history to have a game with 3 homers and 2 stolen bases. And the Dodgers won 20-4, and they clinched officially their playoff berth. I cannot, Kevin, for the life of me, after the guy hit the second homer, I'm not pitching to him. I would not let him swing the bat again. You're already getting blown out, so it's not like it was some strategic thing as to where every run counted. It was like a 10-run game at that point already with the bomb that you just heard coming in. I would never have pitched to him again. They did, and he went 6 for 6 with 3 homers. Insanity.
Yeah, before we get to the game last night, or maybe we should start with the game last night because it was an historic game. You start with just this unbelievable multiple home run game, multiple stolen base game, 5 hits in a game, 10 RBIs in a game. It's unbelievable. Not to mention the home runs. You had a 438-foot blast into the upper deck, a 391-foot shot to opposite field. These were consecutive at-bats, and then in the seventh, that ridiculous 440-foot shot in the ninth. I think a lot of people believe that the game last night was the single greatest offensive output game in history, first player in history with multiple home runs, multiple stolen bases, and 5 hits, at least 5 hits in a game, not to mention the 10 RBI game. He's the first ever with 5 extra base hits and 10 RBIs in a game. So the game itself, if it hadn't come on a night in which he became the first 50-50 player of all time would have been a massive story on its own, because it's just ridiculous. Like, anybody that ever just looks at, you know, major league box scores to see how your favorite team did or to see how your favorite player did, just look up the box score in the Dodgers 20-4 win over the Marlins. First of all, they had, you know, 16 hits in the game, but Ohtani's line of just seeing 6 at-bats, 4 runs, 6 hits, 10 RBIs. That's the most jarring part of the box score line. 3 home runs, no walks, no strikeouts. It's 6-for-6 is amazing. With a walk, that would have meant that he would have remained at 6-6, 6-for-6 with one walk and had 7 at-bats. But in terms of what it looks like historically, like, I'm wondering for the baseball people out there, and I should have asked Tommy this on the podcast on Thursday. I will ask him this on Tuesday. Is Ohtani's 50 home run, 50 stolen base season equivalent to the records in baseball that we don't think, or a lot of fans think, will never be broken, like DiMaggio's 56-game hitting streak, or Ted Williams, the last, you know, guy to hit for 400 when he hit 406? You know, I think some people believe that Bob Gibson's 1.12 ERA at some point could be taken down, but what about Williams and DiMaggio? Does this go into the category, or do people just think Ohtani will do it again? Because here's something interesting about, like, 50 home run guys and then 50 stolen base guys. The average number of stolen bases for the 49 times a player has hit 50 or more home runs in a season is 7.4. So every one of the other 48 seasons with 50 or more home runs, the average number of stolen bases, 7.4. That's crazy that he went for 50. I mean, it wasn't even close to the average. The best ever heading into this season, Willie Mays and A-Rod each had 50 home run seasons with 24 stolen bases. So less than half the number Ohtani has. And by the way, Ohtani's not done. He's at 51-51 right now. So I'd love, and I will, we tried to get a couple of baseball people on today. The baseball people are pretty busy today, but we'll do this when Ohtani's season is over and before maybe the postseason begins. But I'm wondering if 50-50 is the equivalent to DiMaggio and Ted Williams. And maybe even, perhaps, if you want to look at Bob Gibson's 1.12 ERA in a season, which some people think will never, you'll never have one lower. I don't know. Maybe people are just going to expect that Ohtani will do it again. It's amazing, man. The 50 stolen bases alone. There's another part of this that he's been. His percentage, his stolen base percentage of 92.73%, he's 51-55, is the third greatest stolen base season percentage-wise in the history of the sport with somebody with 50 steals. Max Carey in 1922 was 51-53. Ellsbury in 2013 was 52-56. Let me just mention, he could still move up. I mean, he's barely behind Ellsbury. I think one more stolen base, if he was 52-56, would tie Ellsbury. Two more without getting thrown out would pass Ellsbury on the list. It's just incredible, the season he's had. You know, I was watching last night, I was watching Scott's SportsCenter after the show, and there were, you know, multiple guests, but Tim Kirchen was the one I was waiting to hear from. I think my favorite sort of baseball historian that's on television currently. And he said at one point, he's the greatest ever. And Scott had to get him to clarify. And he said, well, he is in the process of becoming the greatest to ever play. You know, he's got to have more longevity. He still thinks, Kirchen does, Willie Mays is the greatest player in the history of the game. But he believes that if Ohtani continues on this course, it'll be kind of a no-brainer conversation that Ohtani will go down as the greatest of all time. I mean, amazing. And the good news is, unlike the last couple of years, we get him in the postseason. You know, we're going to get a chance to see, you know, the Dodgers, where we didn't get a chance to see, obviously, the Angels in the postseason, right? Am I right about that, that he has not played in a postseason game?
You are correct. He's not. Mike Trout's only played in three, and that was like 10 years ago.
Right. So we'll get a chance to see, you know, the possibility of just like the Dodgers Phillies in an NL championship series where you'd have major stars. But really, you know, if you ended up with Dodgers Yankees in the World Series, Ohtani, Soto, and Judge all in the same series would be entertaining. But, you know, a lot of these players over the years, you know, Bonds for many years, you know, kind of on the pitching front, you know, you would certainly put a guy like Clayton Kershaw into this conversation, that a lot of times the way people talk about their legacies, even before they're done playing, is, yeah, but what did they do in the postseason? So the first chance for Ohtani in the postseason will be this postseason. And will he deliver at the same rate that he's delivered in the regular season? I think that'll be a real interesting thing to watch, because some of the greatest to ever to have done it have struggled when they've gotten to the postseason. Bonds was that, you know, guy for years. Kershaw, that guy for years, in terms of two of the greatest to ever do it. So this will be fun. The Dodgers right now are tied with the Phillies for the number one seed. They both have kind of comfortable leads here as we enter the final week and a half of the season in terms of the top two seeds. So neither one of those two teams, the Dodgers, are not going to have to play in a best of three in that first weekend. They'll wait for, you know, either the four seed or three, six seed winner, I guess, or the four or five seed winner they'll wait for. That'll be fun, though, to watch him in the postseason. In fact, I think the baseball postseason is setting up to have as much interest in it as there's been in a long time, primarily because you'll have the Yankees, the Dodgers, you know, the two biggest brands in the sport in the postseason. Not that we haven't had that a bunch recently, but we didn't have the Yankees in it last year. You know, around here, the Orioles will be in it, and the Orioles have not played well recently, that's for sure. They're four back in the AL East. So right now, you know, more likely than not, the Orioles are just going to be the top wild card team and be forced as a three seed to play either Minnesota or Detroit. They're the teams that are battling for that six seed in the American League. But what a performance, what a game. His home runs, man, look different. They are, like, you know, people say about home runs that are hit beautifully, they are majestic. It's those three homers last night were majestic. You know, I heard some guys talking afterwards because I watched some MLB Network late last night just to see some of the reaction. And they said he's really been swinging home run swings, trying to pull the ball in recent weeks. And their point was he doesn't even have to do that, that he is so strong that he hits opposite field home runs just as easily as he does pulling them, but he's been trying to pull them recently. But, man, and we didn't even get to see him pitch this year because, yeah, he's coming off a massive injury and playing hurt all year. Crazy. All right, what else do you have?
All right, how about another historic night in the WNBA? The Mystics and Fever set a WNBA record with the highest attendance in league history. Over 20,711 fans packed Capital One Arena last night for the Mystics Fever game. The Mystics won the game 92-91. Caitlin Clark only played 20 minutes. It was the season finale. The Fever couldn't really do anything in terms of playoff seating-wise. They already locked in, so she barely played. But nearly 21,000 fans in attendance for a WNBA game.
I'm curious, wasn't her first game at Capital One, didn't that set the record? So did this record just break that record?
So this, I don't know if her first game officially set the record or came close to it, but this is for sure the record. I'm trying to find what the previous record was.
I feel like this is a repeat story. Not a repeat story in that this one is brand new. It is. But that we heard this when she was at Capital One the first time. Whatever. I mean, look, she's set every franchise record everywhere she's gone. This has done something to a sport that was completely irrelevant, completely, you know, hidden from most sports fans. And it's been unbelievable. And for the people who know this, because football season has begun, not only did she have the greatest rookie season in the history of the WNBA, her team, which was not supposed to be a good team and not supposed to be a playoff team, qualified for the postseason. And so they have, what do they play here? Best of three? Do you know?
Yeah, it's going to be best of three. Take a wild guess when game one is.
I already saw this. I looked at this last night. They're playing game one, all of the game ones, on an NFL Sunday. That's stupid.
Yep.
I mean, it's just dumb. I think there's great interest. But to get the casual sports fan, in addition to the, you know, few hardcore WNBA fans, you needed to start this thing like Tuesday night, not even Monday night. Don't even go up against Monday Night Football where there are two games. Like, to do a Tuesday, Wednesday, you know, of next week. But all four of the first round series, I think there are just four, right? There are eight teams in the postseason?
Correct. Yeah.
They're all Sunday. It's like 1 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 5 o'clock, and late Sunday night. And the Fever, her team, plays 3 p.m. on ABC.
Right.
Now, these numbers have been outrageous all summer long. But sorry, you're not getting many sports fans to watch Caitlin Clark at 3 o'clock on ABC when the 1 o'clock games are getting ready to come down the wire, and at 4:25 it's Baltimore and Dallas. I think that's just bad idea. They should have gone to Tuesday night. It would have been, they should have planned the regular season to end last night, or tonight, excuse me, and then played the game ones Tuesday and game two on Wednesday. And then go ahead and play game threes if necessary on Thursday. And then the next round should have started the following Tuesday. If they're interested in an audience, I'm just trying to help them out. Because no one's going to watch any of these games. People that have been watching, count me as somebody, when I knew she was playing and the Fever Indiana was on TV somewhere and nothing else was on, I would watch. I'd try to find it and I would watch it. I enjoyed watching her that much. But, you know, most of the people that may have paid attention in August don't even know it's happening on an NFL Sunday. What else?
All right, two more quick ones here. Looks like HBO Max has their next big show of the fall. The Penguin debuted yesterday. I haven't watched it yet. I've had a couple of tweets. Are you interested? Is it on your radar at all, The Penguin?
No. It's not. But The Joker, when it comes out on October 4th, is very much on my radar. I cannot wait to see that movie because the first one with Joaquin Phoenix was brilliant. Brilliant movie. So I am very much looking forward to, I believe it's October 4th.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah. That's one too, by the way. I'll go to a theater and see.
I feel like some of those
The Penguin, not so much. Tell me about The Penguin.
I think you'd actually
see some of the spots for it.
I think you'd actually end up liking this one. Obviously, you're not like a huge comic book fan, but if you put that on the back burner, I think this show is going to be kind of similar to some of the ones that you've enjoyed from HBO. Dark. It doesn't really focus as much on like the goofy superhero stuff as it is more just like a crime-based show that happens to have superhero characters or characters that were made famous in comic books. Again, I haven't watched the first episode. I plan on doing it tonight. It kind of debuted at 9 p.m. on a Thursday with Thursday Night Football, so I was like, all right, I'm not going to do that. But I got time after the show between Illinois and Nebraska, so I'll throw this on for an hour. I've heard really good things about it, and I think Colin Farrell is really, really good. So I'm excited to see his portrayal in a much more extended version than what we saw in the actual Batman movie.
You want to hear something interesting? That the Joker 1 debuted on October 4th, 2019, and the Joker 2 debuts October 4th, 2024.
Yeah, that's
the exact
not,
same date.
That's not an accident.
Why do you say it's not an accident?
I think they kind of aimed for something like that. It just it kind of plays a little bit into this like weird tactical character that the Joker is.
Did you like the Joker one?
I did. I thought it was good. I didn't love it as much as you did, but I'm, you know, I have this like comic book approach where the Joker without a guy in a bat suit is just really a psychopath. And but I'm excited for the Harley Quinn element to this. I think it'll add more.
I mean, what has he done that wasn't very good? Like his roles over the years, brilliant in Gladiator, brilliant in Walk the Line, playing Johnny Cash, brilliant in The Joker. Here, I'll tell you what. I did not think Napoleon was very good. I went and saw Napoleon, did not think it was great. I thought he was fine. I did not think the movie was great. I don't know if you saw it. That was a Ridley Scott movie. I was disappointed with Napoleon. But The Master, phenomenal. Right? I mean, everything pretty much he's been in, he's been great.
He's the second best Joker. I would say by considerable margin, maybe a small margin over Jack Nicholas, but he's the second best guy that's played it.
Jack Nicholson.
Nicholson, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. No, I think that movie was phenomenal. I think it's one of the better performances in recent years. So good. All right. What else? Anything else?
All right. Final thing. Dan Campbell selling his home in Detroit because his address got leaked.
That sucks. That really sucks. You know, I saw the quote, his quote, and I'm pulling it up right now. He said the house that they had, plenty of space, 2 acres, the home is beautiful. It's just that people figured out where we lived when we lost. Now, he didn't elaborate on that, but I guess in a media outlet in Detroit reported that his home address was leaked to the public, and he and his family became the victim of pranks and harassment after tough Lions losses, including the NFC Championship game. I mean, Dan Campbell has brought the Detroit Lions, he brought them to the brink of a Super Bowl for the first time since 1991. They had a home playoff game for the first time since 96. They won a playoff game for the first time in forever. I mean, seriously, that is... Dan Campbell's the best thing to have happened to the Detroit Lions in decades. You know, these guys, you can't leak their home addresses, and then really these guys have to find almost gated communities to live in.
Yeah, it's so weird. That's, I don't know what, like, he's a great coach. I could have sworn that he lived in a gated community, because remember we had that discussion. I guess you remember, I was just kind of a part of it a decade ago when Gruden and RG3 lived across from each other, but they lived in a gated community, so you couldn't get in
out,
there.
Yeah, and out in that Creighton Farms area. Exactly. Yeah, that's an interesting story. I think it's kind of sad that, you know, they're forced to sell a house that they really liked. Hopefully he'll find a place that, you know, if his address gets leaked again, it doesn't matter. All right, what else? Anything else?
That's all I got for you.
All right, you've got a college football preview. I've got a what do you got coming up. We'll get to the NFL card next hour and a smell test for the upcoming games this weekend. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980, the team980.com. We are free and live on the Odyssey app.
All right.
What do you got?
So this morning, Denton, I guess on Greenberg's ESPN show, Get Up, Dan Graziano, you know, the ESPN NFL insider, said the following. He said, the Dallas Cowboys, the Kansas City Chiefs, the Los Angeles Rams, and the Washington Commanders would all, quote, love to add a talented wide receiver, closed quote. Apparently, some of the names mentioned were Devontae Adams, Deontay Johnson. Take it for what it's worth. I think they should be looking to add a talented wide receiver. They have one. Okay, just for those of you that got provoked by the very mention of a report that a credible NFL insider had this morning, it's not that they're looking for their only talented wide receiver. They have a talented wide receiver, but they should be looking for another and perhaps an even more talented wide receiver. And I would certainly think right now, it's early, and maybe it's Noah Brown that emerges. Maybe Luke McCaffrey emerges. Maybe they end up having a great mix of Terry, McCaffrey, Noah Brown, De'Ami Brown. Who knows? We got a long way to go this year. But I would think right now, in addition to, you know, corner, wide receiver would be at the top of the offseason wish list, whether that would be in free agency or whether that would be in the draft targeting somebody wherever they pick. Right now, Denton, I know we're way ahead of ourselves after two games, but right now, top three needs in the draft or in the offseason next year for Washington. I would go corner, wide receiver, O-line, in that order. My number three would be pass rusher.
I would agree with those three. I would say corner, wide receiver, 1A, 1B, and then pass rusher, C.
Yeah, now pass rusher, depending on, you know, who's available, I haven't looked at the free agency market, where they, you know, it would obviously depend on where they are in the draft. It's possible that a pass rusher might be your number one go-to because that's the most talented player on the board when you pick. But those three are your needs right now. Maybe they'll change their mind on what their needs are over the next 15 games. All right, up next, Denton's got we're in week three now of college football.
Week four.
Of college football. Is it week four already?
It is. It flies by.
We're in week four of college football. He's got a college football preview. I'll get to my smell test at 12:25, and then we'll go around the NFL and give you thoughts on each and every NFL game on Sunday. Good football weekend. By the way, it starts tonight. More on that next. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980 and the Team980.com.